Musalisin Maxter Alaren, the guardsman replied. The Eruhin, the hope in your language. Chosen heir of the Emperor. Our commiserations to your Emperor, the battle lord broke in smoothly. Such a grievous loss is to be regretted, but we come only for what is rightfully... You come for the conquest and plunder, Northman, the grey-haired man told him. You'll find only death in these lands. There will be no further parleys, no more talk. We will kill you all as you have killed our hope. Expect no quarter. Now give us his body. Lord Darnell drank from a flask and swilled wine around his mouth before spitting it on the hooves of the guardsman's horse. He breaks the rules of parley with his discourtesies, my lord, he observed to Alhestian. His life is clearly forfeit. No, it isn't, Renin spurred between the two parties, addressing the guardsman. I'll escort you to the body. He could feel the battle lord's fury as they rode over to the corpse, sensing Lord Darnell's hate, remembering something Aspect Arlin had told him. Men who love themselves hate those who would dim their glory. The guardsmen dismounted and lifted the body of their hope onto a pack horse. The grey-haired guardsman tightened the straps, securing the body to the horse, and turned to Valin, his eyes shining with tears.
"What is your name?" he demanded hoarsely.
He could think of no reason not to tell him.
"Valin Alsorna, your consideration does not dim my hate, Valin Alsorna. Eruhin Maktar, hope-killer. My honour tells me I should take my own life, but my hate will keep me alive. From now on, my every breath will be drawn with but one purpose, to see your end. My name is Nelisan Nestor Heverin, captain of the 10th cohort of the Imperial Guard. Do not forget it." With that, he and his comrades had mounted and ridden away.
Sometimes the faith requires all we have. The Aspect's words again, spoken that day last winter, when he walked with Valin on the snow-covered practice field, listening to what he had to say about the king's plans. It had been cold that day, colder than usual even for Weslin. The novice brothers stumbling in the snow as they ran and fought, and bore the sting of their master's canes.
"This will be a war unlike any we have known," the Aspect had said, his breath steaming the air. "A great sacrifice will be made. Many of our brothers will not return, you understand this."
Valin nodded. He had listened to the Aspect for a long time, and found he had no more words.
"But you must return, Valin. Fight as hard as you have to, kill as much as you have to. No matter how many of your men and your brothers fall, you will return to this realm."
Valin nodded again, and the Aspect smiled. The only time Valin had seen him do so since that first day at the Order House gate all those years ago. Somehow it made him seem old, the way it creased the lines around his eyes and his thin lips. He had never seemed old before.
"Sometimes you remind me so much of your mother," the Aspect said sadly, then turned and walked away, his tall form moving through the snow without the slightest misstep.
Scratch came loping up the rise, a cloud of dust ascending in his wake, a hair dangling from his mouth. Large, white-footed hairs seemed to proliferate in the scrublands, and like Scratch, the realm guard had been quick to take advantage of easy game. The slave hound dropped a hair at Valin's feet and gave one of his short, rasping barks.
"Thanks, daft dog," Valin scratched at his neck. "But you can have it."
He lifted the hare and threw it down the hill, Scratch scampering after it with a joyful yelp.
"You usually leave him behind when we go on campaign," Frentis said, sitting down and unstoppering his flask.
"Thought he would appreciate a new hunting ground."
"So he was their Emperor's son, was he?"
Frentis asked, the man in the white armor. "His chosen heir. It seems the Emperor chooses his successor from amongst his subjects." Frentis frowned.
"How's he do that, then?"
"Something to do with their gods, I believe.
Think he would have chosen someone who could fight better. The silly sod couldn't even sit on his horse right."
Despite his young brother's levity, Valin could sense his concern.
"Had no business being there, really."
"Do not worry over me, brother," he gave Frentis a grin.
My heart does not weigh so heavily. Francis nodded and turned his gaze on the vast expanse of desert to the south. Not really sure why the king wants his place so bad. It's all dust and scrub. I haven't seen a tree since we landed. We come in search of what is rightfully ours by ancient treaty, and to avenge the wrongs done us by the Denier Empire.
Yeah, been wondering about that.
You know, the only Alpirans I ever saw were sailors and merchants round the docks. They dressed funny, but they didn't seem no different from all the other sailors and merchants, chasing whores and money the way such folk do. Bit more polite about it than most, though. Can't remember any of my fellow no-good urchins getting abducted and tortured in dark rites. Except me, of course. And one I wasn't no Alpirin. You question the king's word, brother? Frontis's hands moved inside his cloak, no doubt once again exploring the pattern of scars.
His and everyone else's. If I think, I have to.
Valin laughed.
Good. Keep doing that.
My lord! One of the scouts called to him, standing and pointing to the eastern horizon. Valin moved to the other side of the rise and peered into the distance, seeing a faint shimmer in the heat haze rising from the sun-warmed sands.
What am I looking for?
I see it. Frentis had his spyglass at his eye. It was an expensive item. Brass tubes and a shark-skin cover. Valin thought it best not to inquire where he got it, although he remembered that the captain of the Meldinian galley that brought them to these shores had possessed a similar item. Like Barkus, Frentis's thieving instincts had never completely faded.
How many?
Not good with figuring, brother, as you know. But I'll be buggered if there ain't at least our number and a third more besides.
I know you know where he is.
The battle lord's gaze was dark, with boundless enmity.
My lord?
Valin was distracted by the spectacle on the plain before them. Thousands of Alpirin soldiers drawn up in offensive formation, advancing at a steady march towards the rise where they stood. The battle lord had ordered Valin to bring his full regiment to the rise and put his standard on as tall a pole as could be found. On the western slope, out of sight of the Alpirans, were 5,000 Cambrellian archers. Officially, the archers were Fief Lord Muster's contribution to the campaign, a show of allegiance after what had become known as the Usurper's Revolt. But in fact, they were mercenaries selling their bow skills to the king, and no Cambrellian noble was counted among their number. On either side of the rise, the Realm Guard infantry were arrayed in regiments, four ranks deep. To the rear, the Nilsalian contingent of 5,000 light infantry waited, flanked by the 10,000 horse of the Realm Guard cavalry on the right, and the Renfalian knights on the left. Behind them stood four mounted companies from the Sixth Order, alongside Prince Malsius, commanding three companies of the King's Mounted Guard. It was the largest army ever fielded by the Unified Realm, and was about to fight its first major engagement, something that seemed to concern the Battle Lord hardly at all.
The bastard who left me with this!
Alhestian raised his right arm. The barbed spike, protruding from the leather cap covering the stump, glinted in the bright midday sun. His gaze was fixed on Valin, seemingly oblivious to the advancing Alpirin host.
Alcendal. I know you didn't find him taken by some imaginary beast.
Valin had been surprised the Battle Lord had chosen to place himself on the rise, although he supposed it gave him a good view of the field. But he was more surprised at the man's choice of time to pursue a grievance.
My lord, perhaps this discussion can wait.
I know my son's death was no mercy killing, the Battle Lord continued. I know who wished him ill, and I know you were their instrument. I will find Alcendal. Be assured of that. I will settle accounts with him. I will win this war for the king. Then I'll settle with you.
My lord, if you hadn't been so intent on slaughtering helpless captives, you would still have your hand, and I would still have my brother. Your son was my friend, and I took his life to spare him pain. The king is satisfied with my account, in both cases, and as a servant of the crown and the faith, I have nothing else to say on either subject.
They regarded each other in cold silence, the battle lord's rage making his features tremble. "Hide behind the order and the king if you wish," he said through clenched teeth. "It will not save you when this war is won. You or any of your brothers. The orders are a blight on the realm, setting up gutter-born scum to lord it over their betters." "Father!" A tall, fine-featured young man stood nearby, his expression strained with embarrassment. He wore the uniform of a captain in the 27th Cavalry, a black tail feather fluttering from the top of his breastplate, a long sword with a bluestone pommel strapped across his back. At his belt, he wore a Valerian short sword. "The enemy," Aloysius Alhestian said, inclining his head at the host advancing across the plain, "doesn't seem inclined to dally." Velin expected the battle lord to explode at his son, but instead he almost seemed chagrined, biting back his anger, nostrils flaring in frustration. With a final baleful glance at Velin, he strode off to stand beneath his own standard, an elegant scarlet rose at odds with the character of its owner, his personal guard of black hawks closing protectively on either side, casting suspicious glances at the wolf runners surrounding them. The two regiments shared a mutual detestation, and were like to turn taverns and streets into battlefields when encountering one another in the capital. Velin was keen to ensure they were kept well apart in the line of march. "Hot day's work ahead, my lord," Aloysius said, Velin noting the forced humor in his voice. He had been disappointed to find that Aloysius had taken a commission in his father's regiment, hoping the young poet had seen enough slaughter at the High Keep. They had met him frequently in the years since, exchanging pleasantries at the palace when the king called him there for some meaningless ceremony or other. He knew Aloysius had recovered his gift, that his work was now widely read, and young women were eager for his company. But the sadness still lingered in his eyes, the stain of what he had seen in the High Keep. "Your breastplate should be tighter," Velin told him. "And can you even draw that thing on your back?" Aloysius forced a smile. "Ever the teacher, eh? Why are you here, Aloysius? Has your father forced you to do this?" The poet's false smile faded. "Actually, my father said I should stay with my scribblings and my high-born strumpets. Sometimes I think I owe my way with words to him. However, he was persuaded that a chronicle of his glorious campaign, penned by the realm's most celebrated young poet, no less, would add greatly to our family's fortunes. Don't concern yourself with me, brother. I'm forbidden from venturing more than an arm's length from his side." Velin looked at the oncoming Alpirian army, the myriad flags of their cohorts rising from the throng like a forest of silk, their trumpets and battle chants a rising cacophony. "There will be no safe place on this field," he said, nodding at the short sword on Aloysius's belt. "Still know how to use that?" "I practice every day." "Good. Stay close to your father."
"I will."
Aloysius offered his hand. "An honor to serve with you once again, brother." Velin took the hand, more firmly than he intended, meeting the poet's eyes. "Stay close to your father." Aloysius nodded, gave a final sheepish smile, and walked back to the battle lord's party. "Design within design," Velin concluded, pondering the battle lord's words. "Janus promises him my death in return for victory. I get to save my sister. The battle lord gets vengeance for his son." He calculated the many bargains and deceits the king must have spun to bring them to these shores. The entreaties made to Fieflord Theros to bring so many of his finest knights. The unnamed price agreed with the Meldinians to carry the army across the sea. He wondered if Janus ever lost track of the web he wove, if the spider ever mislaid one of his threads. But the notion was absurd. Janus couldn't forget his designs any more than Princess Lerna could forget the words she read. He thought about the aspect again, about the orders he had been given, and how, for all its complexity, the old man's web amounted to nothing.
"Eruhin Maktar!"
The shout went up from every man in the regiment, loud enough to carry to the oncoming Alpirans, loud enough to be heard above their own chants and exhortations.
"Eruhin Maktar!"
The men brandished their pole axes, steel catching the sun, shouting as one the words they had been taught.
"Eruhin Maktar!"
On the summit of the rise, General was waving the standard on a pole 20 feet high, the running wolf rippling in the wind for the whole plain to see.
Eruhin Maktar!
Already the Alpiran cohorts nearest the hill were beginning to react, the ranks wavering as soldiers increased their pace, their drummer's steady beat unheeded as the wolf runner's taunt drew them on.
Eruhin Maktar!
The battle lord was right, Valen decided. Seeing the discipline of the leading Alpiran cohort give way completely, ranks dissolving as men broke into a run, charging the hill, their own shouts a burgeoning growl of rage. The guardsman gave us a weapon, the words and the banner.
Eruhin Maktar,
the hope killer is here.
Come and get him.
And they came. The cohorts on either side of the charging men broke ranks and followed suit, the madness spreading rearwards as more and more formations forgot their discipline and charged headlong for the hill.
Little point waiting, Valen told Dentos.
He had stationed himself with the archers, his own bow ready, arrow notched.
Loose as soon as they're in range. Might make them run faster.
Dentos lifted his bow, sighted carefully, his men following his lead, then drew and let fly. The shaft arching down on the charging Alpirans, a cloud of 200 arrows close behind. Men fell, some rose and charged on, others lay still. Valen fancied he saw a few still trying to crawl forward, despite shafts buried deep in chest or neck. He loosed off 4 arrows in quick succession, as the archer's arrow storm began in earnest, all the time the regiment maintaining its taunt.
Eruhin Maktar!
At least 100 Alpirans must have fallen by the time they were halfway up the hill, but they showed no sign of faltering. If anything, their charge had gathered pace, the base of the hill now thick with men, struggling to climb the rise and slay the hope killer. Valen saw how the whole Alpiran line had been disrupted by the charge, how the flanking cohorts were wavering, undecided as to whether to assault the realm guard before them or turn and try for the hill. This battle is already won, he realized. The Alpiran army was like an ox tempted into the killing pen with a bale of fresh hay. All that remains is the slaughter. Whatever his faults, it was plain the battle lord had a gift for tactics. When the tide of onrushing Alpirans had come to within 200 paces, the battle lord had his own flagmen give the signal for the Cumbrellian archers to move to the summit. They came at a run, longbows ready, reaching into the thicket of arrows already thrust into the sandy soil on the summit, notching and loosing without preamble, as they had been ordered. Valen had fought Cumbrellians on many occasions, acquiring an intimate knowledge of their deadly skills with the longbow, but he had never seen their massed arrow storm before. Air hissed like the breath of a great serpent, as 5,000 shafts arched into the charging mass, producing a huge groan of shock and pain as they struck home. It seemed as if all the Alpirans in the lead companies fell at once, 500 men or more, driven to the sand by the mass of arrows. The air above Valen's head became thick with arrows as the Cumbrellians continued to loose. Glancing back, he marveled at the speed with which they plucked shafts from the soil, notched and loosed, seeing one man put 5 arrows in the air before the first fell to earth. In the face of the storm, the Alpiran rush slowed as men fought to climb over the bodies of dead and wounded comrades, arms and shields raised to ward off the deadly rain, although these seemed to offer scant protection. But still they came on, fueled by rage, some still stumbling forward over the thickening carpet of dead, with multiple arrows protruding from their mail. When they had struggled to within 50 paces of the summit, the battle lord signaled the command for the realm guard regiments flanking the hill to advance. They moved forward at the double, spears leveled, pushing the disrupted Alpiran line back. The Alpiran cohorts wavered but soon rallied, their line holding as horse-borne archers to their rear responded, galloping along the line of battle to loose their shafts at the realm guard over the heads of their embattled comrades. On the right, a cloud of dust rose as Alpiran horses massed for a countercharge at the realm guard's flank. The battle lord saw the danger, his flagmen signaling frantically to set their own cavalry in motion. The neatly arranged ranks of the realm guard horsemen stirred, more dust rising as they maneuvered to face the mass of Alpiran cavalry. The discordant peal of 100 trumpets signalled the charge, 10,000 horse hurtling towards the oncoming Alperin lancers, meeting head-on in a thunderous collision. Through the dust, it was just possible to glimpse the whirling spectacle of the melee, men and horses falling and rearing amidst the din of clashing weapons. Before the cloud became so thick, it was impossible to gauge the course of the struggle, although it was clear the Alperin charge had been checked. The Realm Guard infantry continued their assault without interference, the Alperin line on the right beginning to buckle under the pressure. Whoever commanded the Alperin host belatedly started to exert control over his forces, sending what infantry reserves remained to bolster the disintegrating line, 5 cohorts running forward to hold the momentum of the Realm Guard advance. But it was too late. The Alperin line bowed, wavered and broke, the Realm Guard streaming through the gap to assault the neighboring Alperins from the rear, the whole line breaking apart under the strain in the space of a few minutes. Not a man to miss an opportunity, the Battlelord unleashed Fieflord Theros's knights, the mass of armor and horseflesh thundering through the remnants of the Alperin right, then wheeling around, wreaking slaughter on the Alperins still thronging at the base of the hill, despite the Cumbrelian arrow storm. On the left, the Alperin line started to collapse, as the soldiers saw the havoc being wrought on their comrades at the hill. Panic took hold of one cohort, the whole complement fleeing despite the exhortations of their leaders. The Realm Guard surged into the gap, more cohorts taking to flight as the whole line crumbled. Soon thousands of Alperins were streaming away across the plain, raising a cloud of dust tall enough to obscure the sun and cast the battle in shadow. On the slope before Valin, the surviving Alperins were at last attempting to escape the combined fury of the arrow storm and the onslaught of the Renfalen knights. Seemingly too exhausted to run, many simply stumbled away, clutching wounds or embedded shafts, too spent even to defend themselves when knights spurred amongst them to hack down with mace or longsword. Here and there, knots of men fought on, islands of dogged resistance amidst the tide of steel and horse, but they were soon overwhelmed. Not one man had made it to within sword reach of the summit, and the wolf runners hadn't lost a single soldier. Over on the right, the ever-burgeoning dust cloud spoke of an undiminished fury from the Alperin cavalry, and the battle lord ordered the order companies into the fray. The blue-cloaked brothers were soon swallowed by the dust, and it was only a matter of minutes before Alperin riders began to emerge, galloping westwards, foam streaming from the flanks and mouths of their horses. There were only a few hundred survivors from the thousands of horsemen that had sought to turn the flank of the Realm Guard. Valin glanced up at the pale disk of the sun, tinged red by the dust. "You will witness the harvest of death under a blood-red sun." Words from a dream, spoken by the spectre of Nursus Silnin. The thought that the dream's portent might have a claim on his future left an unwelcome chill in his breast. The body cooling in the snow, the body of someone he had loved, someone he had killed. "Faith!" Dentos exclaimed at Valin's side, gazing at the spectacle before them with a mixture of awe and repulsion. "Never seen the like." "Don't expect to see it again," he replied, shaking his head to clear away the vestiges of the dream. "What we face today was but a gathering of the garrisons of the northern coast. When the Emperor's real army comes north, I doubt they'll offer us so easy a triumph." Chapter 4 The Governor's mansion at Untesh stood on a picturesque hilltop overlooking the harbour, where the masts of the city's scuttled merchant fleet jutted from the water like a submerged forest. The mansion's gardens were rich in olive groves, statuary and avenues of acacia trees, tended by a small army of gardeners who had continued their daily labours without interruption following the Battle Lord's assumption of residence. The rest of the mansion staff had acted similarly, going about their duties with mute civility, which had done little to alleviate the Battle Lord's insecurity. His guards watched the servants with a glowering vigilance, and his meals were tasted twice before proceeding to his table. The dumb obedience of the mansion staff was, for the most part, mirrored in the city's wider population. There had been some trouble with a few dozen wounded soldiers, survivors of what had become known as the Bloody Hill, mounting a shambolic attack on the main gate when the first Realm Guard regiments had trooped through, and meeting a predictable end. But for the most part, the Alpirans were quiescent, apparently at the order of the governor, who before drinking poison along with his family, had issued a proclamation ordering no resistance. Apparently the man had been in command of Alpiran forces the day of the Bloody Hill, and, feeling he had enough slaughter on his conscience, had no wish to face the gods with yet more weighing the scales against him. Despite the lack of resistance, Valen could see the resentment of the people in every snatched glance they cast in his direction, marking the shame that made them shuffle wordlessly about their business and avoid the gaze of their neighbors. Many had no doubt lost sons and husbands to the Bloody Hill, and would nurse their grudges in silence, waiting for the Emperor's inevitable response. The atmosphere in the city was oppressive, made worse by the mood of the Realm Guard, which had soured by the time they marched through the gate, the jubilation of victory fading in the face of the Battle Lord's decision to leave the most badly wounded behind and the lack of plunder to be had in the realm's newest city. The day after their arrival, a gallows had appeared in the central forum, three corpses dangling from the scaffold, all Realm Guard, with signs hung about their necks, proclaiming one a thief, one a deserter, and the other a rapist. The king's orders had been clear. They were to take the cities, not ruin them, and the Battle Lord felt no compunction in ensuring his orders were followed without demur. The men had taken to calling him Blood Rose in grim mockery of his family emblem. It seemed Alhestian's facility for victory was matched by his talent for making his men hate him. Valen guided Spit along the acacia-lined avenue leading from the mansion gate to the courtyard, dismounting and offering the reins to a nearby groom. The man stood still, head bowed, eyes downcast, sweat shining on his skin in the hot afternoon sun. Valen noted the way his hands trembled. Glancing around, he saw that the other grooms had adopted the same stance, all standing immobile, refusing to look at him or see to his horse, accepting the consequences. Eruhin Maktar, he thought with a sigh, tying Spit to a post with enough slack to reach the trough. The council was already underway in the mansion's main hall, a large marble chamber impressively decorated, with mosaics on the walls and floor illustrating scenes from the legends of the principal Alpiran gods. As usual, the council discussion had quickly degenerated into a heated argument. Baron Banders, whom Valen had once seen beat unconscious by Lord Darnell at the Summertide Fair, and who had since regained his position of chief retainer to Fief Lord Theros, was exchanging insults with Count Marvin, captain of the Nilsaelin contingent. The words jumped-up peasant and horse-shagging dullard could be heard amidst the tumult as the two men jabbed fingers at each other and shrugged off the restraining hands of their companions. There had been some bad blood between the Nilsaelins and the rest of the army since the Bloody Hill. Their contingent hadn't been ordered forward until the enemy were already in flight, and most had seemed more interested in looting Alpiran corpses than pursuing their broken army.
"You're late, Lord Valen."
The Battle Lord's voice cut through the commotion, silencing the argument.
"I had far to ride, my lord," Valen replied.
Alhestian had ordered his regiment to camp at an oasis a good 5 miles outside the city walls, ostensibly to guard a fresh supply of water for the next march, but also a sensible precaution against the potentially violent reaction of the city folk to Valen's continued presence within the walls. It also afforded the Battle Lord an opportunity to rebuke him for lateness every time he convened a council.
"Well, ride faster," the Battle Lord told him curtly. "Enough of this,"
he commanded the two fractious lords, now glowering at each other in furious silence.
"Save your energies for the enemy. And before you ask, Baron Banders, no, I will not lift the strictures on challenges. Return to your seats."
Valen took the only remaining chair and surveyed the rest of the council. Prince Malsius and Fief Lord Theros were present, along with most of the army's senior captains, joined by a comparatively junior figure from the Sixth Order, although he still outranked Valen in the Order's hierarchy. Master Solis was as lean as ever, with only a few more lines creasing his forehead and some grey in his close-cropped hair to show the passing of the years. His cold grey eyes regarded Valen with neither warmth nor enmity. They had met only once in the years since the Test of the Sword, a brief, tense exchange of greetings at the Order House, when the Aspect had summoned him for an account of the most recent Nlonak raids. Valen knew he now commanded a company of brothers,
but had made no effort to seek him out. Not trusting himself to control his anger at the inevitable rush of memories the sight of the swordmaster provoked. "My wife," early in Jural's last breath, "my wife."
"I have called you here," the battle lord began, "to issue orders for the next phase of our campaign."
He spoke with a slightly theatrical air, imparting his words with a grave importance, although the impression was spoiled somewhat when he glanced over at his son, seated at a desk outside the circle, to ensure he was making notes. Aloysius smiled at his father, and jotted down a line or two in his leather-bound notebook. Venin noticed he stopped as soon as Alhestian turned back to the council.
"We have won perhaps the greatest victory in the history of our realm," the battle lord went on. "But only a fool could imagine this war is over. We must strike swiftly if we are to fulfill our king's commands. In 6 months, the winter storms will sweep across the Arenian, and our line of supply will be tenuous at best. Linesh and Marbellus must be in our hands before then. Word has come from the king that reinforcements will dock at Untesh within the month. Some 7 freshly raised regiments, 5 of foot and 2 of horse. They will make good our losses and garrison the city against siege. When they get here, we march. It only remains to decide where. Luckily, we have new intelligence with which to formulate a strategy." He turned to Solis. "Brother?" Solis's voice was coarser than Valin remembered, years of shouted commands adding a dry rasp to his tone.
"At the battle lord's order, I conducted a reconnaissance of the defences at Linesh and Marbellus," Solis began. "From the scale of the additional fortifications, and the number of troops visible, it appears the remnants of the army defeated at the Bloody Hill have concentrated on Marbellus. As the largest city on the northern coast, it offers the greatest chance for defence. To judge by the number of abandoned houses and villages in the environs, it appears the common folk have also sought refuge there, no doubt swelling the garrison, but also denuding supplies. In comparison, Linesh appears less well prepared. I counted only a few dozen sentries on the walls, and her garrison stays in the city, making no patrols. The walls are in a poor state of repair, although there appears to have been some effort to remedy this. However, there are no new fortifications, and the ditch around the wall has not been deepened."
"Ripe for the plucking, eh?"
Fief Lord Theros commented.
"Linesh first, then on to Marbellus."
"No," the battle lord said.
He assumed a thoughtful pose, a finger stroking his chin, although it was clear to Valin his strategy had been decided well in advance of this meeting.
"No, it appears Linesh can be taken easily, but to do so would add precious weeks to our march. The road between Untesh and Marbellus is more direct, and Marbellus is the pin on which the ultimate victory rests. Without it, our efforts will have been for nothing. Our way is clear. We must divide the army. Lord Valin."
Valin met the battle lord's gaze, wishing for perhaps the 1,000th time that the Bloodsong had not deserted him. At times like this he sorely missed its counsel.
"My lord?"
"You will take command of 3 regiments of foot, Count Marvin's forces, and 1/5 of the Cumbrelian archers. You will proceed to Linesh immediately. Take the city by storm and hold it against siege. Prince Malcius and his guard will remain in Untesh to govern the city according to realm law. The main force will proceed to Marbellus when the king's reinforcements arrive. We will therefore have all 3 cities in our hands well before the dawn of winter."
There was a moment's uncomfortable silence, several attendees registering surprise or confusion, but Prince Malcius was the first to voice concern.
"I am to be left here whilst the realm guard march onwards into even greater peril?"
"The decision was not mine, Highness. King Janus gave me specific orders before we sailed. I have written copies, if you want them." The prince's jaw clenched, and Valin saw how he fought to control his fury and humiliation. After a moment he spoke again, a barely concealed choke in his voice.
"You expect Lord Valin to take a city with barely 8,000 men?"
"A poorly defended city, by all accounts," the battle lord countered. "And I am sure so vaunted a commander as Lord Valin is equal to the task."
Count Marvin coughed several times, face flushed. In accordance with Nilselling custom, his head was shaven to grey stubble, which, along with the gold ring he wore in his mutilated left ear, gave him the look of an outlaw, a trait he shared with most of his men. "My lord," he addressed Alhestian, "I mean no disrespect to Lord Valin, but I would point out my rank. Rank is unimportant when set against ability and experience," the battle lord interrupted. "Lord Valin has fought and won many battles, whilst you, I believe, have merely engaged in skirmishes with the many outlaw bands haunting the highways of your fief." Count Marvin glowered, but his mouth remained closed despite his obvious anger.
"I cannot believe," Prince Malsius said, "that my father would countenance this plan."
"King Janus gave command of this army to me, Highness."
Alhestian's tone was one of forced civility, but his entirely reciprocated dislike of the prince was palpable. The argument continued, rising in volume as Valin pondered the plan. From what Solis had said, taking the city might not be a major problem, but holding it was another matter. So far, no mention had been made of the Alperin forces, which were probably already marching northwards. No doubt, in considerable numbers, and Linesh stood at the extreme end of the principal route through the hills, fringing the eastern edge of the desert. It would almost certainly be the first target before the Alperins turned to Marbellus, made all the more tempting by the presence of the Hope Killer. To call it a vulnerable position was a considerable understatement, as the Battle Lord well knew. He rids himself of a rival for glory, Valin thought, knowing that the Alperins will assail Linesh with all their might to revenge themselves on the Hope Killer, thinning their ranks in the process, whilst he wins eternal fame by taking Marbellus and holding it against siege. And by rendering me so vulnerable, he provides the Alperians ample opportunity to give him the revenge he craves. He frowned, remembering the Aspect's instructions. Vulnerable, away from the main body of the army, away from so many curious eyes. A tempting target.
"I believe this is an excellent plan," he said brightly, quelling the blossoming fracas.
Prince Malsius stared at him, appalled.
"My lord?"
"Battlelord Alhestian has difficult choices to make, yet none can doubt his gifts for strategy after our recent victory. We should not lose faith in him now. I will happily accept this commission, and," he gave Alhestian a grave bow of respect, "I thank the Battlelord for the honor."
"You do see the trap in this, I assume?"
Valin unhitched Spitz's reins from the post and led him onto the gravel path, not looking at Solis.
"I see many things these days, master."
"Brother," Solis corrected. "Brother commander, if you must. The days when you called me master are long past us."
"And yet," Valin checked the saddle strap and palmed away the dust on Spitz's flank, "it seems to me like yesterday."
"You're no longer a child, brother. Sulking ill becomes a sword of the realm."
Valin turned on him then, anger rising in his breast. Solis met his gaze and made no backward step, one of the few men who would never be afraid of him. He knew he should welcome the company of such a man, but the test of the sword hung between them like a curse.
"I have my orders from the Aspect," he told Solis, "as I'm sure do you. I am merely attempting to follow them. The Aspect ordered me to take my company into this carnival of fools. He did not say why."
"Really?
He told me more than I wanted to hear."
He fixed his eyes on Solis's face, ready to read the reaction to his words.
"What do you know of the Seventh Order, brother? What can you tell me of the One Who Waits? What intelligence have you on the Aspect massacre?"
Solis blinked. It was his only reaction.
"Nothing. Nothing you don't already know."
"Then leave me to my trap."
He put a foot in the stirrup and hauled himself into the saddle. Glancing down at Solis, he saw something in his face he had never expected to see. Uncertainty.
"If you see the realm again, and I do not," Valin said, "tell the Aspect I did what I could.
The Aspects, all seven of them, should seek counsel with Princess Lyanna. She is the hope of the realm." He spurred Spit into a gallop and tore away, a cloud of gravel in his wake, exultant in the finality of his course.
"Linesh. I will have answers in Linesh." It was a clever plan. Hollis Nestor Arawan, governor of Linesh, was a portly man of about 50, with a jeweled ring on each of his stubby fingers and a mingled expression of fear and anger on his fleshy face. They had found him in a small study off the mansion's main hallway, and his wrist bore a bruise from when Frentis had twisted a dagger from his grasp. He offered no reply to Velin's words, and spat on the intricate floor mosaic, closing his eyes and breathing a heavy sigh, obviously expecting death.
"Gussy bugger, isn't he?" Dentos observed.
"Leaving a gap in the wall," Velin went on. "Only making a show of repairs, whilst you prepare a spiked ditch behind for us all to fall into. Clever."
"Just kill me and have done," the governor grated. "I am dishonored enough without suffering your empty platitudes."
He gave a conspicuous sniff, wrinkling his nose.
"Is shit the natural aroma for Northmen?"
Velin glanced at his heavily stained clothing. Frentis and Dentos were similarly besmirched, and exuded an equally appalling stench.
"Your sewers need some attention," he replied. "There are several blockages."
The governor gave a small moan and grimaced in realization.
"The drain in the harbor."
"Indeed. Easily accessible at low tide, once the bars were removed. Brother Frentis here spent 4 nights creeping across the sands at low tide to scrape away the mortar." Velin went to the window and gestured at the tower above the main gate. A flaming torch could be seen waving back and forth in the darkness. "The signal confirming our success. The walls are in our hands, and your garrison is captured."
"The city is ours, my lord."
The governor looked at Velin closely, scrutinizing his face and clothing.
"A tall warrior in a blue cloak," he murmured, eyes narrowing. "Eyes of black with a jackal's cunning. Hope killer."
A profound expression of sorrow covered his features.
"You have doomed us all by coming here.
When the Emperor learns you are within our walls, his cohorts will burn the city to the ground, just to burn you."
"That won't happen," Velin assured him. "My king will be angry if I oversee the destruction of his newest dominion."
"Your king is a madman, and you are his rabid dog."
Frentis bridled. "Watch your mouth!"
Velin held up a hand to silence him. "If insulting me relieves your guilt, then feel free to do so. But at least allow me to present our terms." The governor frowned in puzzlement.
"Terms? What terms can there be? You have conquered us. You and your fellow citizens are now subjects of the unified realm, with all the rights and privileges that entails. We are not here as slavers or thieves. This is a thriving port, and King Janus desires it remain so, with as little disturbance as possible to its current administration.
If your king expects me to serve him, he truly is mad. My life is already forfeit. The Emperor will expect me to take the honorable course. As well he should."
"Hasta!"
There was a shout from the doorway, and a girl burst into the room. She was in her mid-teens and dressed in a white cotton shift. Her eyes were wide with fear, and a small knife was clutched in her hand. Frentis moved to intercept her, but Velin waved him back as she rushed to the governor's side, positioning herself between them, waving her knife at Velin and glaring in defiance. Her words were heavily accented, and it took him a moment to comprehend them.
"Leave my father alone!"
The governor put his hands on her shoulders, speaking softly into her ear. She trembled, eyes brimming with tears, the knife shuddering in her hand. Velin noted the gentleness with which the governor calmed her, taking the knife from her and pulling her close as she collapsed in tears.
"In Untesh," Velin said,
"the governor's family were obliged to join him in death. This land has some strange customs." The governor shot him a guarded look of resentment and continued to cradle his daughter.
"How old is she?" Velin asked. "Is she your only child?"
The governor gave no reply, but his embrace tightened on the girl. "She has nothing to fear from me or any of my men," Velin told him. "They have orders to avoid bloodshed wherever possible. They will be quartered within strictly ordered limits and will not patrol the streets. We will pay for any food or goods we require. If any of my men abuses one of your citizens, you will report it to me and I will see him executed. You will continue to administer the city and see to the needs of the population. Existing taxes will continue to be collected. One of my officers, Brother Canis, will meet with you tomorrow to discuss the details. Do I have your agreement, my lord? The governor stroked his daughter's hair and gave a curt nod, shame bringing tears to his eyes. Velen gave a formal bow of respect. Please forgive the intrusion. We will speak again soon. They were moving to the door when it hit him. The blood song, a hammer blow in his mind, louder and clearer than he'd ever heard it. Velen tasted iron in his mouth and licked his upper lip, finding blood gushing from his nose in a thick stream. He felt himself growing colder and stumbled to his knees, Dentos reaching out to steady him as blood spattered onto the mosaic. A fresh wetness on his cheeks told him his ears were also bleeding.
Brother!
Dentos' voice was pitched high in alarm. Frentis was on the verge of panic, sword drawn and glaring warningly at the governor, who looked down at Valen with a mixture of terror and bafflement. His vision swam, and the mansion faded, mist and shadow closing around him. There was a sound in the gloom, a rhythmic clunk of metal on stone, and a vague image of a chisel chipping at a block of marble. The chisel moved unceasingly, faster and faster, faster than any human hand could wield it, and a face began to emerge from the stone.
Enough!
The voice was a blood song. He knew it instinctively. Another blood song. The tone was different from his own, stronger and more controlled. Another voice speaking in his mind. The marble face dissolved and drifted away like sand on the wind. The sound of the chisel stopped and did not resume. Your song is unschooled, the voice said. It makes you vulnerable. You should be wary. Not every singer is a friend. He tried to answer, but the words choked him. The song, he realized. He can only hear the song. He struggled to summon the music, to sing his reply, but all he could produce was a thin trill of alarm. Don't fear me, the voice said. Find me when you recover from this. I have something for you. He summoned all his remaining strength, forcing the song into a single word. Where? The image of the chisel and the stone returned, but this time the marble block was whole, the face it contained still hidden. The chisel lay atop it, waiting. You know where. Chapter 5. He awoke to a smell more foul than even the sewers of Linesh. Something wet and rough scraped over his face, and he became aware of a crushing weight on his chest.
Get off him, you filthy brute!
Sister Gilmer's stern command made his eyes flutter open, finding himself face to face with Scratch, the slave hound giving a happy rasp of greeting.
Hello, you daft dog, Velen groaned in response. Off!
Sister Gilmer's shout sent Scratch skulking from the bed, slinking into a corner with a petulant whine. He had always treated the sister with a wary respect, perhaps because she had never shown the slightest fear of him. Velen scanned the room, finding it mostly bare of furniture, save for the bed and a table, where Sister Gilmer had arranged a variety of vials and boxes that held her curatives. From the open window came the keening of gulls, and a breeze tinged with the combined odors of salt and fish. Brother Canis commandeered the old offices of the Linesh Merchants Guild, Sister Gilmer explained, pressing a hand to his forehead and feeling for the pulse in his wrist. All roads in the city led to the docks, and the building was standing empty, so it seemed a good choice for a headquarters. Your dog was frantic until we let him in the room. He's been here the whole time. Velen grunted and licked his dry lips.
How long?
Her bright blue eyes regarded him with a moment's wariness before she went to the table, pouring a greenish liquid into a cup and mixing in a pale white powder.
5 days, she said without turning. You lost a lot of blood. More than I thought a man could lose and still live, in fact.
She gave a wry chuckle, the inevitable bright smile on her lips when she turned back, holding the cup to his lips. Drink this.
The mixture had a bitter but not unpleasant taste, and he felt his weariness receding almost immediately.
5 days.
He had no sense of it, no lingering memory of dreams or delusions.
5 days lost.
To what?
The voice, the other blood song. He could still hear it, a faint but persistent call. His own song answering, the vision of the marble block and chisel vivid in his mind. Sella's words in the fallen city becoming clearer. There are others, older and wiser with the same gift. They can guide you.
I have to... He raised himself up, trying to draw back the covers.
No!
Gilmer's tone brooked no argument, her plump hand pushing him back into the softness of the bed. He found he didn't have the strength to resist.
Absolutely not. You will lie there and rest, brother.
She pulled the covers up and secured them firmly under his chin. The city is quiet. Brother Canis has things well in hand. There is nothing requiring your attention. She drew back. For once her face was entirely serious. Brother, do you have any idea what happened to you?
Never seen the like, eh?
She shook her head.
No, I never have.
When someone bleeds, there has to be an injury, a cut, a lesion, something.
You show no sign of any injury.
A swelling in your brain that could cause you to bleed like that would have killed you. Yet here you are. There was some wild talk amongst the men about Governor Arawan trying to kill you, with a dark curse or some such. Canis had to put a guard on his mansion, and hand out a few floggings before they calmed down.
Floggings, he thought. I never have to flog them.
I don't know, sister, he told her honestly. I don't know why it happened. I just know what caused it. It was another 2 days before Sister Gilmer released him, albeit with stern warnings about overexerting himself and making sure he drank at least 2 pints of water a day. He convened a council of captains atop the gatehouse, from where they could observe the progress of the defences. A thick pall of dust was rising from the workings as men toiled to deepen the ditch surrounding the city and make good the decades-long neglect of the wall. "It'll be 15 feet deep when completed," Kane said of the ditch. "We're down to 9 feet so far. Work on the walls is slower. Not too many skilled masons in this little army." Valen spat dust from his parched throat and took a gulp of water from his canteen.
"How long?"
he asked, hating the croak in his voice. He knew his appearance was not one to inspire great confidence, his eyes deeply shadowed with fatigue and his pallor pale and clammy. He could see the concern in the eyes of his brothers and the uncertainty of Count Marvin and the other captains. "They wonder if I'm fit to command," he decided. "Perhaps with good reason."
"At least 2 more weeks," Kenneth replied. "It would go quicker if we could conscript labor from the town."
"No." Verin's tone was emphatic. "We have to win the confidence of these people if we are to rule this place. Pushing a shovel into their hands and forcing them to back-breaking toil will hardly do that."
"My men came here to fight, my lord,"
Count Marvin said, his tone light, but Valen could see the calculation in his gaze. "Digging is hardly a soldier's work."
"I'd say it's most certainly a soldier's work, my lord," Valen replied. "As for fighting, they'll get plenty of that before long. Tell any grumblers they have my leave to depart. It's only 60 miles of desert to Antesh. Perhaps they'll find a ship home from there."
A wave of weariness swept through him, and he rested against the battlement to disguise the unsteadiness of his legs. He was finding the burden of command, with all the petty concerns of both allies and subordinates, increasingly irksome. His irritation was made more acute by the insistence of the blood song calling him to the voice, and the marble block he knew lay somewhere in the city.
"Are you unwell, my lord?" Count Marvin asked pointedly.
Valen resisted the urge to punch the Nilsalian squarely in the face, and turned to Bren Antesh, the stocky archer who commanded the Cumbrelian bowmen. He was the most taciturn of the captains, barely speaking in meetings, and the first to leave when Valen called a halt. His expression was perpetually guarded, and it was plain he neither wanted nor needed their approval or acceptance, although any resentment he may have felt over serving under a man the Cumbrelian still referred to as the Darkblade was kept well hidden.
"And your men, Captain?" he asked him. "Any complaints about the workload?"
Antesh's expression remained unchanged, as he replied with what Valen suspected was a quote from the 10 books.
"Honest labor brings us closer to the love of the World Father."
Valen grunted and turned to Frentis.
"Anything from the patrols?"
Frentis shook his head.
"Nothing, brother. All approaches remain clear, no scouts or spies in the hills."
"Perhaps they're making for Marbellus after all," offered Lord Alcordlin, commander of the 13th Regiment of Foot, known as the Blue Jays, for the azure feathers painted on their breastplates. He was a sturdily built but somewhat nervous man. His arm still rested in a sling after being broken at the Bloody Hill, where he had lost a third of his men in the fierce fighting on the right flank. Valen suspected he had little appetite for the coming battle, and was unable to blame him. He turned to Canis.
"How goes it with the governor?"
"He's cooperative, but hardly pleased about it.
He's kept the people quiet so far. Made speeches to the Merchants Guild and the Civic Council, pleading with them to stay calm. He tells me the courts and the tax collectors are operating as well as can be expected in the circumstances. Trade is down, of course. Most of the Alperian ships put to sea when news spread we had taken the city. The remainder refused to sail, and threatened to fire their ships if we tried to seize them. The Valerians and Meldinians seem keen to take advantage of the opportunity, though. Prices for spice and silk have risen considerably, which means they've probably doubled back in the realm. Lord Altrendel, commander of the 16th Regiment, gave a suppressed huff of annoyance. Valen had forbidden the army to have any part in the local trade for fear of accusations of corruption, severely disappointing the few nobles in his command with money to spend and an eye for profit.
"What about the food stores?" Valen asked, choosing to ignore Altrendel.
"Full to the brim," Kenneth assured him. "Enough for 2 months' siege, at least. More if it's carefully rationed. The city's water supply comes primarily from wells and springs within the walls, so we're unlikely to run short."
"Provided the city folk don't poison them," Ren Antesh said.
"A good point, Captain," Valen nodded at Canis. "Put a guard on the main wells." He straightened, finding his dizziness had subsided. "We'll meet again in 3 days. Thank you for your attention." The captains departed, leaving Canis and Valen alone on the battlements.
"Are you all right, brother?" Canis asked.
"A little tired is all." He gazed out at the trackless desert, the horizon wavering in the midday haze. He knew he would one day look out at this scene and behold the spectacle of an Alperian host. The only question was how long it would take them to arrive. Would they leave him enough time to accomplish his task?
"Do you think Alcordlin could be right?" Canis ventured.
"The Battle Lord will have Marbellus under siege by now. It is the largest city on the northern coast."
"The Hope Killer isn't in Marbellus," Valen said. "The Battle Lord drew his plans well. He'll have a free hand at Marbellus, whilst the Emperor's army deals with us. We should have no illusions."
"We'll hold them," Canis said with flat certainty. "Your optimism does you credit, brother."
"The king requires this city to fulfill his plans. We are taking but the first step on a glorious journey towards a greater unified realm. In time, the lands we have secured will become the fifth fief of the realm, united under the protection and guidance of King Janus and his descendants, free from the ignorance of their superstitions and the oppression of lives lived at the whim of an emperor. We have to hold." Valen tried to discern some irony in Canis's words, but could detect only the familiar blind loyalty to the king. Not for the first time, he was tempted to give Canis's brother a full account of his meetings with Janus, wondering whether his devotion to the old man would survive knowledge of his true nature. But he held back, as always. Canis was defined by his loyalty. He cloaked himself in it, as protection against the many uncertainties and lies that abounded in their service to the faith. Quite why Canis was so devoted, Valen had never been able to divine, but he was loath to rob him of his cloak, delusion though it might be.
"Of course we'll hold," he assured Canis with a grim smile, thinking, "Whether it makes a thimble worth of difference to anything is another matter."
He moved to the stairway at the rear of the battlement.
"I think I'll take a tour of the town,"
Barely seen it yet.
I'll fetch some guards. You shouldn't walk the streets alone.
Velen shook his head.
Worry not, brother. Not so weakened that I can't defend myself.
Kenis was still unsure, but gave a reluctant nod.
As you wish.
Oh, he said as Velen began to descend the stairs. The governor requested we send a healer to his house. Apparently his daughter's taken ill, and the local physicians lack the skills to help her. I sent Sister Gilmer this morning. Perhaps she can foster some goodwill.
Well, if anyone can, it's her.
Assure the governor of my best wishes for his daughter, will you?
Of course, brother.
The woman who answered the door to the stonemason's shop regarded him with naked hostility, her smooth brow set in a frown, and her dark eyes narrowed as she listened to his greeting. She seemed a year or so shy of 30, with long dark hair tied back in a ponytail and a dust-stained leather apron covering her slender form. From behind her came the rhythmic thud of metal on stone.
"Good day, madam," he said. "Please forgive the intrusion."
She folded her arms and gave a curt reply in Alpiran. From her tone, he assumed she wasn't welcoming him inside with an offer of iced tea.
"I was told to come here," he went on,
her stern gaze giving no insight as to her understanding, her mouth fixed in a hard line, offering nothing. Velen glanced around at the mostly empty street, wondering if he could have misread the vision somehow. But the blood song had been so implacable, its tone so certain, compelling his course through the streets, only subsiding when he happened upon this door, beneath the sign of a chisel and hammer. He resisted an impulse to push his way inside, and forced a smile.
"I have business to discuss."
Her frown deepened, and she spoke in heavily accented but unmistakable words.
"No business here for Northmen."
Velen felt a faint murmur from the bloodsong, and the hammering from the interior of the shop fell silent. A male voice called out in Alpiran, and the woman gave a grimace of annoyance before glaring at Velen and stepping aside.
"Sacred things here," she said as he entered. "Gods curse you if you steal."
The interior of the shop was cavernous, the ceiling high and the marble tile floor covering 30 paces square. Sunlight streamed through open skylights, illuminating a space filled with statuary. Their size varied, some a foot or two in height, others life-sized. One was at least 10 feet tall, of an impossibly well-muscled man wrestling a lion. Velen was struck by the vitality of the form, the precision with which it had been carved, seemingly freezing the giant and the lion at the moment of greatest violence. There was another, smaller statue nearby, a life-size woman of arresting beauty, her arms outstretched in supplication, and her fine features frozen in an expression of depthless sorrow.
"Herlia, goddess of justice, weeping as she passes her first judgment."
On hearing the voice, the blood song rose in pitch, not in warning, but in welcome. The man stood with his hands on his hips, a chisel and hammer hanging from the pockets of his apron. He was short but well-built, his bare arms knotted with muscle. His face was angular, with high cheekbones, almond-shaped eyes, and the parts of his skin not covered in dust had a faint golden sheen.
"You're not Alpiran," Velen said.
"Neither are you," the man replied with a laugh. "Yet here we both are." He turned to the woman and said something in Alpiran. She gave Velen a parting glare and disappeared into the rear of the shop. Velen nodded at the statue.
"Why is she so sad?"
"She fell in love with a mortal man, but his passion for her drove him to commit a terrible crime, and so she judged him, consigning him to the depths of the earth, chained to a rock, where his flesh is eternally eaten by vermin."
"It must have been quite a crime."
"Indeed. He stole a magic sword, and with it slew a god, thinking him a rival for her affections. In fact, he was her brother, Ixtus, god of dreams. Now, whenever we suffer nightmares, it is the shade of the fallen god taking his revenge on mortal kind."
"A god is a lie, but it's a good story."
He held out his hand. "Velen Alsona, brother of the Sixth Order, sword of the Unified Realm, and now commander of the foreign army occupying our city. An interesting fellow indeed, but we singers usually are. The song leads us down so many paths. The man shook his hand.
I'm Lin, humble stonemason at your service.
All your work?
Velin asked, gesturing at the array of statuary.
In a manner of speaking.
Armlin turned and moved deeper into the workshop, Velin following, his gaze drinking in the carnival of fantastic shapes, the seemingly endless variety of form and tableau.
Are they all gods?
He asked.
Not all.
Here. Armlin paused next to a bust of a grave-faced man with a hooked nose and heavy, deeply furrowed brows.
Emperor Camarin, the first man to sit on the throne of the Alperian Empire.
He seems troubled.
He had good reason. His son tried to kill him when he realized he wasn't going to be the next emperor.
The idea of choosing a successor from amongst the people, with the gods' help, of course, was a dramatic break with tradition.
What happened to the son?
The emperor stripped him of his wealth, had his tongue cut out and his eyes blinded, then sent him forth to live out his days as a beggar.
Most Alperians think he was being unduly lenient.
They are a fine people, courteous and generous to a fault, but unforgiving when roused.
You should remember that, brother.
He gave Velin a sidelong glance when he failed to reply.
I must say I'm surprised your song led you here.
You must know this invasion is doomed.
My song has been inconsistent of late. It has told me little for a long time. Until I heard your voice, it had been silent for over a year.
Silent? Armlin seemed shocked, his gaze becoming curious.
What was it like?
He sounded almost envious.
Like losing a limb, Velin replied honestly,
realizing for the first time the depth of loss he had felt when his song fell silent. It was only now it had returned that he accepted the truth. The song was not an affliction. Sela had been right. It was a gift, and he had grown to cherish it.
Here we are.
Armlin spread his arms wide as they arrived at the rear of the workshop, where a large bench was covered in a bewildering array of neatly arranged tools, hammers, chisels, and oddly shaped implements Velin couldn't name. Nearby a ladder was propped against a large block of marble, from which a partly completed statue emerged. Velin drew up in shock at the sight of it. The snout, the ears, the finely carved fur, and the eyes, those unmistakable eyes. His song was singing a clear and warm note of recognition. The wolf. The wolf that had saved him in the Erlish. The wolf that had howled its warning outside the House of the Fifth Order, when Sister Henna came to kill him. The wolf that had restrained him from murder in the Martish.
Ah!
Armlin rubbed at his temples, his expression pained.
Your song is strong indeed, brother.
Sorry. Velin concentrated, trying to calm the song, but it was a few seconds before it subsided.
Is it a god?
He asked Armlin, gazing up at the wolf.
Not quite.
One of what the Alperians call the nameless, spirits of the mysteries. The wolf features in many of the named god stories, as guide, protector, warrior, or spirit of vengeance. But it is never named. It is only ever just the wolf, feared and respected in equal measure. He regarded Velin with an intent gaze.
You've seen it before, haven't you?
And not captive in stone. Velin was momentarily wary of disclosing too much to this man, a stranger with a song that had nearly killed him after all. But the warmth of his own song's welcome overcame his distrust.
It saved me. Twice from death, once from something worse.
Armlin's expression showed a brief flicker of something close to fear, but he quickly forced a smile.